Greetings, Raise community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Adam Wise, who serves as Vice Chancellor of University Advancement at UMass Boston. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you, Brent. Nice to be here.
Well, this is going to be a lot of fun. I have known Adam for many years, having started Evertrue in the Boston technology ecosystem almost 15 years ago. One thing about Boston is the tech ecosystem is well connected, but the advancement ecosystem might even be better connected. And it's really a community where it seems like everybody knows everybody, and we are fortunate to cross paths with Adam early on. But that being said, I know I'm going to learn a lot, and so will our listeners, about Adam's journey. And so with that, I'll ask you my standard kickoff question, which is, take me back to junior year of high school. Who was that Adam? What was he into? And what led you ultimately to Northeastern University?
Well, it's interesting because I do ask that of people I interview too. How'd you kind of get here? You know, for me, in terms of advancement, it's always an interesting angle, since there's not a real education field where you get your degree and, you know, you become a finance person or something, however you may go in your field. But I got a flyer in a mailbox at my prep school and said, hey, come to pizza night and call some parents and ask them to support Andover. And I thought, oh, you know, so I did. And it was actually kind of fun. You got to pick the parents you called. I called some of my friends' parents, most of whom I never knew, but I knew the friends.
Talked to them. What was the script? I mean, you're like on a landline.
Yeah, they gave you a script to say, you know, hi, you know, my name is Adam. You know, Brent and I play soccer, you know, on the team together, and I'm here actually in the alumni office. And would you consider making a gift to Andover? It would support scholarships and some of the programmatic initiatives we're doing. And they would give you a number, you know, would you make a gift of $100 this year? I mean, it's very, you know, but they gave you the script after having some pizza and some Coke, soda, mind you. And it was, I actually had fun. I had some really nice conversations with parents. I did it a couple.
It wasn't awkward. It was sort of natural for you, because I'm sure for some kids, especially at that age, because you're what? I mean, you're 15,
older.
16, you know, at that age. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I was 15 or 15 and a half, something like that. And I was a kind of talkative kid. Now, I guess I'm a talkative old person. And I think it was natural. It turned out, I learned that there were some of the people who were there were admission tour guides who were students, some of my friends who played on sports teams. And it was just kind of a pizza night, you know, they had a picture of pizza or something. And we went, I did it a couple of years. I had fun. I happened to see a similar flyer actually on the Northeastern kiosk. And I said, all right, you know, I'll go. And with my dad, who said, you know, there is this field called development alumni relations or advancement now.
Well, you walk into Northeastern and you're like, hey, I have 3 years of experience. And that had to help you hit the ground running.
I actually kind of became like a little helper to help other, junior members join and get through the script and all the rest. I had fun. It was a fun experience. And I didn't find it painful. I found it painless. You're just talking to people. You kind of follow a script and ultimately at the end say, would you make a gift of $100 or $1,000 or $10,000? And a little sweaty armpits on the larger asks, I suppose, but it was fun. I really enjoyed it. And that was kind of my entree. And then I ended up doing an internship, at Andover as well. I was a class agent for my class and raised some funds there. And, I worked with a gentleman who ran the place, Alan Adrian, so I still remember him, and he was great. He said, look, I'd like for you to do a couple of stints, work in the annual fund for a couple of weeks, work in leadership gifts for a couple of weeks, corporate and foundation relations. So I got a little bit of a run of the place to learn what the different shops were, and really enjoyed that experience. I actually got to go to sit in on some foundation approaches that they made to Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Ford Foundation. It was a really great experience. Wow. Job opened up at Brooks School. I went to there, worked for 4 years there at a beginning of a campaign, just learning about campaigning, doing some alumni work, doing some event work, working in research, a little bit of major gifts, then went to Boston University and from then on up to here. So that was kind of my foray. It was really an accidental responding to a flyer in the mailbox to come make some phone calls.
Give me a window into the boarding school world, which some of our audience might be familiar with, but I'm going to say the majority sort of nationally doesn't really have as much familiarity with. From an advancement perspective, what's the same? What's different, if anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting about the prep school world is, of course, it's a very small world, right? You're often in a school that maybe is 1,000 students. Andover was around 1,100 at that point. Brook School was about 340 at that point, still around there, I think, now. I think the boarding school experience is a very warm and friendly experience. I was at Boston University for a long time. Here, you know, these bigger institutions, Michigan, USC, you know, it can be much different going to a place like this than, say, Wesleyan, where you have a small campus. The prep school world is a very warm and friendly. People really know each other. You get into the collegiate world where there may be 300,000 alums or 500,000 alums. And it's a little more fractured. But I found the phone calls and the courting, as I've now done fundraising for prep schools, it's the same thing. You're trying to build a relationship with a parent, with an alumnus, maybe with a foundation or corporation, engage with them and see if they would support the institution that you work. It really is no different in the great scheme of things between a prep school and a college, small college, or a major research one university.
Yeah. But what I imagine has to be difference would be the warmth of the lead quality, if you will. When you talk about really tight-knit, small community or, you know, parents and the level of engagement. I mean, tell me a little bit about your transition to Boston University, because when you got there, mid-90s, and I was fortunate to get to know Scott Nichols on the journey as well, who I think entered the scene in your career later. But the way he describes it, even when he started in, let's call it the mid to early 2000s, was that it was sort of a largely uncultivated, you know, disengaged community. And so for you to go from a place like Brooks, which is even smaller and more intimate, for example, than in Andover, to Boston University in the mid 90s, like, what was that like? I mean, that had to be a pretty big transition.
It was, I'd say it in two different ways too. One was the transition between when you're at a prep school, you're not at a research university. So what you're really asking alumni, parents, and friends for is scholarships, a professorship, to name a classroom or a wing of a building. And it is very insular. It's a small group, you know, 12,000, 22,000 alumni, whatever there may be. You go to Boston University, that's one class, right? That, you know, the entire alumni base at a prep school. But now you're in a very different world, because there's a real opportunity to make a case to an alum for scholarships and professorships and programmatic initiatives and buildings and all the rest. But now it's also about research, that you can really court somebody who's interested in whatever field they may be interested in. And there's, at a major university, there's probably something that we're doing in research that we're trying to cure this disease or help this group or whatever we may be doing, that they could invest in. And so it opens up a whole new field of opportunities when you're having a conversation, because, you know, in our field, Brent, as you know, it really is about donor intent. You can want to go to somebody and say, hey, we really need a new hockey pavilion. Well, they didn't play hockey and they have no interest in hockey. And yeah, it may be important for the school, but it's not important for them. So it really is, as we say, about donor intent. What is the donor interested in? And so you need to build that relationship, find out who that person is, and find if there is some connective tissue between your institution and that individual, again, foundation or corporation. So that big transition was this now entirely new field to play on and try to add that to, you know, to your quiver in terms of getting another opportunity for someone who'd like to make a difference in the world. Maybe they'd like to invest not in scholarships, but in research. And so to me, it was just a giant opportunity, much bigger than the prep schools. But the prep school world is a great world to work in, please. But I just found it much more fulfilling at the college and university level.
So tell me about that. I mean, it almost sounds like the difference between, you're walking into a restaurant and there's the special of the day, and that's sort of the one thing on the menu versus a really expansive menu at Boston University. And at the same time, when you're the wait staff, it's hard to know all the details of how every item on the menu tastes and so on and so forth. I've always been impressed by the ability for great fundraisers at that university level to be able to go a mile wide and an inch deep and really, balance being a generalist, identifying the donor interests, and then kind of having to go back and just be the bridge to parts of campus or individuals who you as a fundraiser maybe have never even met or don't know anything about personally. And so, how do you, I guess, think about coaching and training people who are joining in that context to sort of be curious, but also be realistic about how much you possibly could know as the individual fundraiser?
I think it's a really interesting question, Brent, because there can be this fear factor to that. How can I possibly know law and management and arts and sciences and fine arts and communication and all the rest, athletics? But that's where there's this generalist specialist opportunity. We like to look at this, and this is my previous protocol, and here is partnerships. Right, that we're trying to build a relationship. Let's talk about just alumni. We're trying to build a relationship with a graduate here, and that alumna has some interests. When I find out, when one of our colleagues finds out what that interest is, then you try to pair them up, perhaps with the chair of a department, with a faculty member, with the dean, the specialist, because there's no way that any of us can talk expansively. Yes, you say the 1 inch deep, we probably can, but we can't go 6 feet deep about why they should support this social studies program or this environmental studies program or this management program or this education school. We want the specialist, the chair of the department, the faculty member, the dean, perhaps the provost, or at BU the president, or at UMass the provost, the chancellor. We want the head of school to be involved in those. So we want to build the relationships. We want to talk generally about what's going on, find out that area of interest, and then try to pair that alum with someone on campus. And that's where the partnership is really important. And that's where you're going to have the best connective tissue between the donor and their interest and what we're doing here at the school or at the university. And that's where I think it works very well. So no one has to fear. Oh my God, I got to learn 14 schools or colleges. No, you don't. But you do have to learn to talk to people and listen. What are they interested in? Find out, be inquisitive about what their interests are, and then try to pair that with your school or college.
What you're describing to me sounds like such a critical element of fundraising, and one that I really hope can be radically streamlined by artificial intelligence. And I don't think it has been quite yet, but we were just recently at the Big Ten Development Conference, and there was a presentation by a gentleman named Drew Wham at Penn State and a couple of colleagues around the Big Ten. And there was this slide that they laid out that almost sounded like what you just shared. And on the left side of the slide, it said philanthropic interests. And on the right side, it said fundable initiatives. And the idea that donors are revealing in conversations, discovery visits, what they do professionally, public information that we know about the donors, gifts they've made elsewhere, what their philanthropic interests are. And then every university has a set of fundable initiatives, which could be written summaries, it could be campaign initiatives, it could be faculty research, it could be campaign planning, it could be the website of the university that outlines all of these. And that today it can oftentimes like feel as a fundraiser that I go and I sit down and I have the discovery visit, and then I come back and I'm like Googling or playing a game of telephone to try to figure out which fundable initiative might best match what I just learned about the donor. And it just feels like that's the kind of space where we should be able to say, boom, based on everything Adam has shared with me, based on his historical giving history and the funds he's given to already, based on what we can find about Adam publicly as well, and we mash all of that up against our fundable initiatives, here's idea 1, 2, and 3 for Adam that is not based on telephone and Googling. Does that resonate, Adam, like directionally? Do you see the need?
No, I mean, well, 2 ways of that. I mean, one, on the AI side, yeah, that's where I think we can use the empowerment of AI, and we've got to get people to train and use it correctly. But I think that's where you can do the summation quickly. There's an interesting part to that, which I just want to touch on because I do think it's really important, which is about longevity. That when you're at an institution and you know that turnover is one of our problems in our field, and I know you've seen it in so many institutions you've worked with, again, still the data is, you know, 3 years roughly average. People move around. A lot of it's because of salary and opportunities to move up. Some of it's other reasons too. But it hurts the field. When you've been in an institution for a long time, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, you understand that institution. And so you really know what's going on there. And so as you're talking with people, it becomes so much easier to connect the lines that may be something that someone is most interested. A donor will always give to something they really care about a lot more than they'll give something you want or the thing that's on the printout that that the university made, you know, 2 years ago. But the AI angle is a real world immediacy. You know, they said this. What do you think for ABC? And let the system tell you. It gives you information. See how perfect it is, I don't know. But I want to just put a plug in for longevity.
Oh, yeah.
Institution's really important.
Yeah, because look, in a certain sense, you're developing your own algorithm based on your experience. And, you know, let me just flip the longevity question back to you, because given the 3-year statistic you just highlighted, which we certainly have seen in the data and also experienced anecdotally, how did you make it over 20 at BU?
Well, part of it was a joy. I mean, I really loved the mission. Scott Nichols, my VP, was terrific. Our team was great. I was overseeing 14 of the schools and colleges there. Our president, Bob Brown, was magnificent. And the mission of that place was terrific. But I got to go out, and this was almost like an advanced degree you get, because you're going out and visiting, just like I am here at UMass Boston. You're seeing someone in finance. Well, that's different from someone else who's actually in the real estate area of finance. You're seeing a doctor, you're seeing a lawyer, you're seeing an educator, you're seeing all these different people, and you learn from those experiences. To me, it's incredibly enriching. I have learned so much from the alumni, the parents, the friends, again, the foundations or corporations, the people who I've crossed paths with, but the depth of those relationships, and they are not friends, but they're acquaintances and relationships in many respects. You know, you've been working with them for 3 years, then 5 years, then 10 years, then 20 years. Well, they've probably given you gifts along the way. The biggest gifts that I've raised, my teams have raised, and in the places I've worked, have always come from the relationships that have been deepened, and where you're going back to them after showing that their investment of whatever the dollar give that they gave before, that the university did well with it and invested it well, and it made these results with these students or whatever it may have done with these research dollars that they contributed. Now you're going back to them to see if they would contribute again, obviously at a higher level. You can't do that if you're gone in 3 years. So the depth of those relationships for me at Boston University, and now here for 6 years, where I hope to end my career, I'll stay here until they kick me off the island. You know, this is where the length of stay matters. I'm proud to say that virtually almost all of the people who I brought on after I started in 6 years, almost everybody has stayed. I had a really solid team in my previous port of call as well, where most people stayed for the length of the campaign and beyond. And so to me, that's part of the heartening thing. That's part of what kept me there for so long, Brent. And now I think what's going to keep me here until I roll up and shipped off.
Well, I'd be better off asking your team, but they're not on right now. So I'll just ask you, what do you think you have learned and applied that is supporting longevity, loyalty in not only an industry of high turnover, but in a city where it is very easy to explore new opportunities without even having to uproot your family, which, you know, is common in many other parts of the country. So not necessarily saying what are your secrets, but are there themes or principles that you found have supported both you being more loyal to Scott and others and the institution, but that you're seeing play out in on your team as well?
You know, I think in many respects, so much of it is about sharing the thanks, is about a culture of support and partnership. It's about making sure people understand that maybe that frontline fundraiser was the one he or she who closed the gift, but there were people who got that alum to come to events. There were thank you notes that were written. There were checks that were given and get the gifts and process team, whatever one may call them, entered that gift in and generated that tax receipt. There were opportunities for them to engage here on campus in different ways. We want so many people in our office to really share in the results. And I think sometimes in some offices, a lot of times where you hear people say, I closed this, I did that. It's corrosive. I'd like to feel, and we do this, we did this in my previous protocol, we do it here. We're going to do it next week, in fact, collaborative gift cases, right? So that the team sits down, the whole office sits down during one of our retreats and talks about a gift that happened. And 12 people might be up on the stage and talk about their little parts. Everyone was involved in that. And I think part of the tension that happens in offices also is about a competitiveness. I want there to be competition, a healthy competition, but we don't want people stealing prospects or cannibalizing somebody's events or whatever they may do. You want the office to work really together and for us to share in our successes. And I'd like to feel like a hallmark of the people that we've brought on over the years, both here and in my previous ports, have all had a similar feeling. They feel it's collegial. They feel we're coming together. They feel it's about us and we and not I and not them. And I think that's hugely important to longevity, to keeping people close. I also feel like we don't want to make it a hierarchy. Make the organization somewhat flat, share the information, acknowledge success at all levels. And it ain't just gifts. It's about alumni engagement. It's about processing paperwork from a gift transaction or whatever it may be. It's all sorts of different parts of this organization, any organization, that play a very distinct role, even though that person who may have gotten the gift was the one who gets credit for it. We like to do shared crediting. I'll give you one last thing, which is I started something a while back, probably 20 years ago, and have it here as well, where we give you credit to everyone 100% who is involved in that gift in any way. So we may raise, BU, for instance, raise $100 million. We might give $1 billion of internal credit, right? Because we want to acknowledge all sorts of folks who are involved in that. And I just think it's very important. I like to feel, Brent, that it helps keep people together and know that this is a team and they're deeply involved in it.
Yeah, look, I think I love that, Adam. Thank you for sharing. Those are really, I think, strong themes and tactical advice that people can take back. And if you're listening and you don't feel like that collaborative culture of sharing credit exists at your institution, share this podcast with your team and say, hey, look, like at this minute mark, I thought these were some interesting ideas. If you feel like you're, certain silos aren't as connected to the work, or that there's, you know, too much of a major gift is the all-star, you know, culture. I think a lot of what Adam just shared really resonated. And ultimately it's consistent with what you said about the most fulfilling and successful donor relationships that you've managed, where you've been able to truly steward them, demonstrate the impact of their work, of their gift, and inspire them to do more. And it sounds like you've developed your own version of sort of internal impact reporting, internal stewardship, where you can take the same sort of stories that are inspiring the donor to do more and also being able to help your team understand how their work connects to that impact story. And we think about that a lot. You know, as a vendor in the space, we're even further removed than your team, but we're constantly saying, hey, if we can connect, you know, an engagement signal that we derive to an assignment that happens to a frontline officer, and then the frontline officer plans the trip, and then a proposal is created, and then revenue is generated, and a scholarship is formed. Well, we got to get that all the way back to our software team that helped track that very first signal. And so we have our own version of that that I think about often. And I know that motivates, I'm not going to say it motivates people more than money, but the blend of that kind of mission and impact with fair compensation, I think, allows any employer to differentiate in today's market.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. And you know, and what Evertrue's done has been so helpful for our teams as they go out on the road. I mean, it really does make a difference what you allow us to do, you know, virtually and in a click. And I do think too, not surprising, the mission of your institution matters. I'm not necessarily pulled into the grateful patient concept. I don't think that my working for a hospital would be the right thing. Others can. Great. Same with arts organizations, social service organizations. For me, it's education. For me, it's a major university, because that to me is that escalator, that elevator up. If you can get folks who don't have an opportunity, perhaps couldn't afford it, a scholarship, they might come to your community college. They might come to your university. They might come to your college. And couldn't otherwise come if it wasn't for scholarships, perhaps, that we were raising. But that institution then helps guide that student and hopefully sets them on a path for a career for life. And now you don't have to be at a college, become a master electrician, right? Get that skill. But we've got 8.6 million jobs right now in America that are unfulfilled. I travel around, I'm meeting, you know, different C-suite and CEO executives all around the country. They're all saying the same thing. We can't find talent. We can't. We got jobs galore. We can't fill them. There's something like 18% of the jobs are six-figure jobs. I mean, it's extraordinary, this opportunity. And yet part of it is because we're not pushing out not just universities, but all sorts of areas within the United States. We're not pushing out the talent. We're not pushing out the educational opportunities to give the skills to that person who can have a better life if they have them and take one of these jobs that right now is unfulfilled.
Well, tell me a little bit more then. Let's shift the conversation to UMass Boston, because you joined 6 years ago. I have been fortunate to spend some time on campus. I used to live around the corner in South Boston. And when you talk about mission and the student profile and the game-changing intervention that the institution can have in many lives, at the same time, I know you walked into a relatively immature advancement organization, which is maybe similar to where you walked into Boston University in the mid-90s. And so just walk me through what you were inspired by when you considered the role, and then what you've experienced so far, what you're excited about, and also what some of the challenges have been.
Yeah, no, it really was. There were some real parallels. BU wasn't raising much money, was very fractured. Same thing was here.
I mean, you're definitely not the guy who's like, hey, I'm going to, you know, walk into the well-oiled machine twist the dial a little bit this way or that way.
It was a bit of a leap of faith. You don't go from a campaign at BU. I had left when it was $1.6 billion. We started at $1 billion, end up raising $1.8. You don't go from there necessarily to a shop that was raising about $12 million a year. Whether you looked at 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, I say we were remarkably consistent in our underperformance. But I felt there was a tremendous opportunity. And as a private school kid, someone who worked in private schools, went to private schools, I'm trying to look at my career. Where do I want to end? To me, it was intriguing to work for what I consider, and I say that UMass writ large, five campuses, but UMass writ large. If you put us in almost any other state, we'd be one of the top institutions. But in little teeny Boston, right, with Harvard and Wellesley and Tufts and BU and BC and, you know, go down the list from MIT and all the rest, we're so overlooked. But in almost any other state, we'd be among the top. And I always felt that this institution, again, UMass is a system, but UMass Boston in particular, because this was the mission that was so intrigued to me, this one campus, was hugely punching under its weight. And you almost never heard about it except for some bad thing that was going on. And when I looked into this, they came after me, but when I looked into this, it was, you know, a bit of a leap of faith, but I felt there were such opportunities here. I knew we could raise a lot more. I knew we can engage a lot more alumni. I knew we could attract more foundation and corporate support. But I also knew we were going to inherit, or I was going to inherit, a shop that's going to have to be changed. I did a reorganization. It was painful. Some people had to go. We recreated a shop. We did something similar to my previous protocol. But what happened? We began drawing people in. The first year, we doubled our giving, and we got some flack from that. Oh, you're just lucky. Well, the next year, we raised $23 million. Next year, we raised $24 million. So we weren't that lucky. But we did it collectively. We did it by bringing people together, engaging our alumni, our faculty. We took deans on the road to see some people who really had never done that. Our chancellor, Catherine Newman, at interim at that point, was terrific. We got her on the road. And we began to really put some ideas forth and began to engage some alumni and some parents. And the results were, you know, were terrific. And now we've taken it to the next level with our new chancellor, not new, but our chancellor, Marcellus Wazorowsko, started 4 years ago. I say new because of COVID and all the rest. When he started, he just had his inauguration only a couple months ago in April. But now we've taken that to another level. And now we raised $40 million, and now we've been 30 plus each of the last 3 years. And I would say we're just beginning to hit the ball into the, you know, into the bleachers. No grand slams yet; those are coming. But it really is because the mission—that's what drew me here, Brent. You know, we are a majority minority campus. We have tons of alums who are around, most of whom are very disconnected. When I started, we had about 800 alums, parents, friends, 800 people who would attend receptions. We've been growing that under Allie Duffy, who's our vice chancellor, associate vice chancellor for alumni engagement. We've been growing that. We're now, this year, we had 3,500, just top 3,500 alumni, parents, and friends attending events, basically quadrupling the numbers. And interesting enough, the dollars are, you know, tripling. And so we've done it by getting out and seeing folks, building relationships, and using, I think, this campus and the mission of this campus as a way to say, come join us, partner with us, be proud of your institution. Let me tell you what UMass Boston is today, which perhaps you might not have felt that 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So to me, that was the journey, and it was a leap of faith. And I'm so glad I'm here. And it's really been a terrific 6 years so far.
It's an inspiring story, but I have to press a little bit because the mission hasn't changed that much. I'm sure it's evolved, and maybe the vision has evolved, you know, under new leadership, but the mission was the mission 6 years ago. The difference is execution wasn't there. And I feel like there are people listening right now thinking to themselves, my institution also has a great mission, but we are not doubling or tripling. And I feel like we could be. And some of what you just outlined are the basics. And I think some of what I learned from you all at Boston University were getting the basics in place, strong engagement, getting people to events, following up with people, turning the events into visits and conversations, turning that into proposal. It's just, I think what you're reinforcing is the mission alone is not enough to generate philanthropy. It has to be mission with execution. And when you think about just the playbook, you know, the basics, 1, 2, 3, if you're not doing X, Y, and Z, how would you audit the alignment of execution relative to mission if you were going to consult or evaluate a different institution or opportunity?
You know, I think a lot of it really is about building relationships, and it's building relationships on campus with faculty and chairs and deans. It's building relationships with our alumni. You know, there was a book that Ed Fuller wrote or did ran Marriott International, built a bunch of hotels there. That was called it was something like "You can't lead with your feet on your desk," and I would say you can't raise funds with your feet on your desk. You've got to get out and build relationships with people. You have to meet them where they are, which sometimes is electronically meeting them where they are too. But it also is about nuance. It's about how you engage people, how you listen to people, how you respond to the folks you're coming in contact with, again, whether alumni, parents, friends, foundations, or corporations. And I think here we just weren't doing that. We also weren't coming up with the ideas. You know, ideas matter. Well, we didn't have a Stone Living Lab, which is now, I think, doing some seminal work in coastal resiliency and nature-based solutions. We didn't have, this was just something established just 5 years ago with some of the ideas here with some of the great researchers here, and Kathy and Jim Stone and the Stone Foundation. We didn't have that. We didn't have a sports leadership administration program that New Balance and Jim Davis and our leader here, Joe Cooper, put together to try to draw more young people into the athletic fields in different ways as managers, as coaches, as marketers, and all the rest. So it was coming up with ideas like this that began to unlock some of the resources. And I think that's one of the missed opportunities. As you said, you know, kind of much earlier, you know, the institution has a little list of the priorities that are important. That's fine, but you also have to listen to what is out there and what the opportunities are and what you could do if you created a partnership with an alum, a parent, a friend who would make a major investment, and how you can enhance that institution, staying true to your mission. But enhance that institution. And I find that that's something that, you know, we're kind of scrappy. We're entrepreneurial here. And yet, perhaps years back, we weren't such. But I think that's some of what's drawing in the new dollars. Our Paul English Applied Artificial Intelligence Institute is something that's very creative. Paul's idea was really to democratize AI. He didn't want just AI going to the Tony Privates and the elites learning how to use AI. He wanted to make sure all students, especially here, got to understand, have some fluency in AI. And his position was, if you don't know it, if you don't know how to use it, and you're applying for a job and someone else is applying for a job, they're going to have a leg up on you. Or same thing, if you're in a job and there's a promotion opportunity, someone's using AI creatively and you're not, they're going to have a leg up on you. And so he wants to democratize that. Again, it's a partnership that we created with one of our graduates, but it was driven by his idea and the opportunities that we have here on campus. So I think some of those things, Brent, factor into to all the mixture that you're asking about.
Well, what I love about the Paul English example, who, by the way, is one of the first entrepreneurs I got exposure to when I was starting Evertrue, and has inspired so many and has given so much time to our community, the entrepreneurial community, the boss community, your community. It's almost ironic that I feel like it's counter to what I outlined earlier, which is, hey, we've got a set of philanthropic interests, we've got a bunch of fundable initiatives. How can we leverage AI to match those up? I think some of what you're highlighting is, if an AI lab or an AI program isn't one of the defined fundable initiatives, well, then the AI is never going to make that match. But if you listen to somebody like Paul English, all of a sudden it can become a fundable initiative when you see the potential to align with your overall mission. And so there's an element of like, yeah, if we have things on the menu, it would be great to know the preferences of the donors to make the match. But also, once in a while, you got to put a new special on the menu when somebody walks in the restaurant.
I think you have to look at it as a buffet, Brent. I mean, you mentioned this earlier about going to a restaurant and talking about the menu. I'll add to that. It's a buffet, right? You go into a restaurant, a Chinese restaurant, whatever you want to say. It's a buffet. You get 50 choices, but you also do have the menu. But sometimes you got to ask, right? And I think, again, that's that listening. That's so important in our field, is listening to other people, listening to what they're interested in, trying to blend that to what's happening at your institution.
Well, some of what you've outlined as well is you just must feel like you're also just continually doing continuous education personally. Like you might, I feel like you've just been a student your entire career, the way you're describing all of the different research and people mm-hmm. that you're getting exposed to. I mean, you all just must, what a gift it is to just be able to learn constantly.
And that, again, you know, you talked about longevity. That's a part of what to me has been a joy of working for an educational institution. I have just learned so much. I'm not a professor, but I consider myself an educator yeah. because that's part of what I'm doing. I'm learning, but I'm also trying to project what I learned to other, whether mentoring, you know, our young people in the field, making sure everyone is learning, whether best case or a mistake that was made, learn from both sides of that, try not to repeat the mistake, but learn from both of those. But it is about that absorbing of information. And boy, it is so enriching to work for a university or college or prep school, whatever. So enriching to work in a place like this, because the sustenance that you get from the work is so thrilling. It really is. I have a joy every day. It's like everybody else in their field. It's hard work and stressful and all the rest, but it is joyful. Because of where I am and the mission that we have.
Yeah, I love it. We're approaching time here, so I'm going to try to bring it home. But we did ask you in the pre-interview questionnaire, what do you think will or should be the next step forward for the advancement industry? And I loved your answer, so I'm going to read it here.
Please.
You're not letting the virtual world and ease of AI supplant the face-to-face work of our field. And I, first of all, could not agree more. You know, my hope is that AI can reduce friction that prevents people from having face-to-face conversations, both in person and virtually, and can unlock more authentic conversations, hopefully like the one we're having right now, mm-hmm. which will lead to philanthropy. But what you're highlighting is there's a risk that that might not be the case and that it could lead to feet up on the desk if we don't think about it the right way.
100%. I mean, you know, this is a belly to belly. This is a contact sport, right? The best work we do is not by email or text. We do have to have electronic conversations, as you and I are doing. We need the electronic usage just as we use, and this is no ad, but just as we use Evertrue. We need these things to help do our job, but we can't raise money with our feet on our desk. We can't engage our alumni only virtually. We have to go out and build relationships to them, engage them, listen to what they're interested in. And that's going to lead us to more philanthropic support for these institutions. And AI can't supplant us, you know, no robots yet. I think our best work, Brent, you know, is really done face to face.
Yeah, look, one of the things that I've shared with my team as well is, for example, we have tried to embrace remote work and hybrid work in a big way, but that doesn't mean no travel, right? Remote work does not mean no travel. In fact, it might mean even more travel in certain roles and responsibilities. And that's something that I think there was obviously a period during COVID when it was remote work and no travel allowed. But we have to get the pendulum swinging back the other way. And it doesn't mean I also think sometimes travel can be a crutch where it's like, oh, you know, I won't talk to Adam until the next time that I've got a trip to Boston planned. Well, that shouldn't be what governs, you know, me talking to Adam. So it's got to be a blend of virtual conversation, remote conversation, in-person conversation, and a high level of activity at all times. To, you know, sort of create that contact sport aspect in the way you're describing.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've not been a fan necessarily, again, just talking frontline fundraisers, of dollar goals, right? That, oh, you're great if you hit this goal and you're not if you didn't hit the goal. I'm much more interested, and my team is much more interested, our managers are much more interested in activity. Yeah. Right, that you're out there building relationships, you're sitting in front of people, you're proposing, but it can't just be I had a big close this year and next year I didn't, so I was great 1 year and not good the next. It's about activity, and that activity really matters. And the people who are the most active, every time I've seen it, they are the most successful.
I love it. Well said. Hey, let's couple of themes here. Let's do some sure. shout outs. One, just who are your mentors? You've referenced a couple along the way, but people that you specifically would want to call out as having made an impact in your career.
Yeah, I mean, Scott Nichols was my beat, but at BU, you know, it was extraordinary working with him. Bruce McClintock, Martin Lundy, who I think is overseen more as a consultant, more billion-dollar campaigns than anyone in the world. He was remarkable. John Brown, who passed, John Brown Limited for Planned Giving. You know, those were people I worked closely with in different ways, and certainly the mentorship aside from that. But you know, coming from the Boston area, to be at a time kind of in the early 2000s to now, to be listening to, reading, going to conferences with, and hearing, crossing paths with, you know, Jim Husson at BC, Brian Lee, at least a while back at Tufts, now Harvard, although about to go, Sue Paresky at Dana-Farber, Tamara Rogers, you know, at Harvard. You know, amazing people along the way. When you think of, again, Little Boston, those couple of half a dozen folks I just mentioned, again, consultant Bruce McClintock aside, those Boston area leaders of the key development shops, just some of them, you know, collectively raised tens of billions of dollars for their institutions. The impact is extraordinary. I learned a lot from afar, not working with them directly. And I'm proud of the work they've done for this city, for the alumni, the students, the institutions, the research that happens at all these different universities. You know, those to me were impactful. Again, different levels, very close with Scott Nichols in particular. And then the two people who I'd have to say have been remarkable for me, Bob Brown is the president of Boston University, traveled all over the country with him, and Marcellus Rosa Roscoe, our chancellor here. I have learned and am learning so much from these experiences with these two heads of schools. I feel so blessed to have had those opportunities to listen, to learn, to hear their experiences and what they're doing as we engage alumni, parents, friends, foundations, and corporations. It's been a joy and a real education for me, just those two gents alone.
Thank you for sharing. Really great tribute and good reminder of how connected and collaborative this industry is relative to many. We had also asked you about team shout outs you'd like to extend. I've done almost 200 episodes of the Raise podcast, and you might be the first person to respond, our faculty. And I love that response. Tell me more about why you feel that way. It stands out.
This was true at Andover, it was true at Brooks, true at BU, and true at UMass Boston. I find when we go out in any of those places and you visit with, again, graduates, you visit with an alum, and you hear from them, invariably, the ones who are disconnected too will sometimes, I haven't seen anyone in 25 years. What, you know, and so, and it's, they're very disconnected. Invariably, that conversation will come back at some point. They're saying, oh, is Professor X or Professor Y or Professor Z still working there? And you say, yes, you know, or yes or no. And they'll say, oh my God, you know, I was in a class with them and they took a dropper out and they put it in a beaker and it turned yellow and they did another one, it turned blue, another turned red as it chemistry. And all of a sudden it electrified me about this. They talk about the faculty. The faculty made the difference. And even in the institutions, again, BU and now UMass Boston, were again a little sleepy in terms of advancement, not in terms of the strength of the universities. The faculty made a difference to those alums. And so it's allowed us to engage with them because they were so impacted by that institution's faculty, not necessarily the institution even, but their lives were changed. And we hear this routinely. Their lives were changed by a certain faculty member. So to me, the shout out's not necessarily to my team, not necessarily to others, it's the faculty because 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, they changed the life of an alum. And that allowed us to engage them and hopefully allowed us to generate some investment in this institution that will support future generations of students. It is a virtual world. It's also a cyclical world, right? And that's where we need to remember. It's a cycle.
Well said, Adam. Thank you for sharing. As we wrap up here, are you hiring? If people want to be in touch with you, How should they best connect?
Yeah, listen, we're, quietly, we're hiring. We've got as I said, a very strong and loyal team here. We're always looking for, folks in alumni relations, stewardship and donor relations, corporate foundation and leadership gifts, like everybody. We're focused on small hires in key areas. Contact us, and we'd love to hear from those who are talented and experienced and wanting to learn. This is a hell of a place to work, and it's the joy of my life to be here.
Well, Adam is easy to find. He's on LinkedIn. Reach out, let him know you heard this episode. And I've got to just take a minute, Adam, on that note, to give a quick shout out. I was at the Case Summit just a couple of weeks ago in New York, and a guy came up to me named Graham Smoleski. And Graham is at LaSalle University. And he came up to me and he said, "Hey, I just have to say thank you." And I'd never met him before. And I said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Well, you shared a podcast recording with Dan Allen, who was then at DePaul University. And Dan became president of LaSalle University. And after I heard Dan on the Raise podcast, I reached out to him, introduced myself. We did a professional introduction call. Fast forward to Dan being named president at LaSalle. He reached back out, said he was looking for somebody to help lead the development team. And I got my job because I listened to the Raise podcast. I almost started crying, Adam. It made me really happy. And I told Graham that I would absolutely give him a shout out. So, Graham, here you go. Thank you. But to everybody listening, if you made it this far, it can be that simple. Listen, engage. It's not that different than doing development work. It is a full contact support sport to advance your career as well, and some of the same tactics that lead to great conversations with donors are the same ones that have led Graham to this new career opportunity, and I know he's not alone. So
Yeah.
thank you for letting me go down that tangent, Adam.
Yeah, you listen. It's a great life. You can really have a wonderful life in this field, in whatever part of the field you're in, an advancement. And I would encourage more people to join. It's hugely, hugely beneficial and rewarding.
Well, thanks for the important work you do, Adam. It is inspiring to learn more about your story. We're grateful to be on the journey with you, and look forward to continuing to push forward. With that, I'm going to close today's episode with Adam Wise, who serves as Vice Chancellor for University Advancement at UMass Boston. Thanks, Adam, and take care, everybody.
Thanks, Brent. Take care.